The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Today I'm going to continue with a series of talks on mindfulness of speaking. I started last week, continue for another 2 or 3 weeks. And when people think about mindfulness of speaking, I think there's a fair number of people who will quickly think about the ethics of speaking. What's right speech? What's wrong speech? The importance of speaking the truth, speaking kindly, things like that. But we'll get to that. That's kind of the advanced part. And before the ethics of morality of speech, I think there's a lot to be learned about learning to track and be mindful of oneself, even before one begins to speak, or during. So that mindfulness of speaking is a very important part of what I want to talk about here in this series. And there's a lot to be mindful of prior to speaking, in speaking, and after we speak. And part of mindfulness practice is to be not only attentive and present for what's actually happening, but also to be reflective in a very useful way of what's about to happen, what our intentions are, what's going to happen, and also afterwards to reflect a little bit what happened just then, and think about it. Sometimes when people do mindfulness practice or teach it, it can seem that the present moment is the god of mindfulness. You're supposed to be in the present moment, you know. And if you're too much in the present moment, that's all you do. I read once, many years ago, I pulled a book down from the shelves at Stanford Library. I don't know how it happened, just kind of randomly one day. I never did it before, really, or can't remember many times doing that, just randomly pulled the book down and opened it randomly. And this book, I don't know what it was about, some strange topic. But the page I opened it to, it said something like, being in the present moment is a marketer's dream. You know, just shop, don't think about tomorrow. You just shop. And so there needs to be some wider reflection. If you're only in the present moment, then maybe you miss some important pieces of information of how to take care of things. So reflecting afterwards and reflecting prior, and while we're doing it, an important part of mindfulness practice or Buddhist practice. And then we reflect on ourselves in speaking before and during. There's a lot to pay attention to. And as a kind of overarching theme for today's talk, I'd like to tell a short story, once upon a time story about that special monastery, where they had, in the special monastery, they had two seats for the abbot, or two abbot seats, two like this, the main teacher seats. And one was occupied by the actual abbot, and the other, on the other side of the altar, was always empty. And when new monks would come to the monastery, they thought, they were kind of perplexed by why was there one teacher seat that was always empty? Was the teacher away for a long time, or were they waiting for some wonderful person to show up and fill that seat? And then after some time, some of them would ask, what's going on with that empty seat, the teacher seat? There's two abbot seats and only one, we only have one. And then they were explained that, in fact, the second teacher of the monastery is a very important entity, very important thing that goes on here, that's been here longer than any of the monks, current monks in the monastery. And that is the relationship that exists between all the practitioners there. And there is you, there is me, and then there's the relationship that gets formed between us. There is my wishes for myself, my self-concerns, perhaps. There's your wishes for yourself and your self-concerns. There's my wishes for how you treat me, how you see me. There's your wishes, perhaps, of how you want what you want from me. And then, but in addition to that, there's something which is invisible, which is why the seat is empty in the monastery, and that is the relationship that gets formed. It's like a third party. It's like in a marriage. There's the one spouse, there's a second spouse, and then there's the third spouse, which is the relationship that gets formed between them, which is like a third entity that needs to be cared for and attended to and has its own requirements or needs or unfolding that is a little bit different or quite different from what is needed by any individual in the marriage or in the relationship. And so it's then people don't often think about what goes on in relationship, in the relationship that gets formed. Sometimes people are very self-preoccupied, and sometimes people are very focused on the other person. Sometimes it can be both, looking at it two individuals. But there's this third thing that happens. And you see it very clearly sometimes when someone is having a hard time, perhaps, and you can come along and want to give them advice. I have great advice, let me tell you. or there can be intimidated by the challenge of the person, and so, you know, I'm intimidated, so I'll just shut down and walk away or something. Or a person can offer their listening, their presence, their care. And because there's a presence and silence and care, sometimes something new can unfold. There's they can create a caring environment. And so in between the two people, there's a relationship, an atmosphere, a mood of caring that goes on there. So what is the relationship we have? So in almost any situation we find ourselves in, whether it's interpersonal or intrapersonal in ourselves or with objects outside of us, there's what's happening, and there's the relationship that exists between them. And so we attend to that relationship and what goes on in that relationship. And part of that has a lot to do with the relationship we offer the situation. How are we relating to it? So there's what's happening and how I'm relating to that situation. How we're relating to any kind of given situation, how we relate to any person, is often a very multi-layered phenomena. Many things can be happening at once. And so when we want to look at mindfulness of speaking, what goes on in this phenomenally important interpersonal event of speech. We talk to each other. So much gets communicated. So much gets channeled. Some of the best, most important things that happens in people's lives and worst things that can happen in people's life can happen through speech. I think it's useful to begin kind of tuning into the layers of what's going on there. And one of the very useful things to look at is the relationship that we have towards the person we're talking to, but also the relationship we have to the relationship, to the atmosphere, the mood, the situation that's being created by the two people. Is there an environment that fosters intimacy or caring or honesty or, you know, something in that? Or are we somehow engaging in it like you're treating the person as an object or the event as an object or as the, you know, the subject of the conversation is the most important thing? And so let me just tell you the subject. But there's something else happening. So even when it's something as unwise as gossip or slander, it's interesting to look at what's happening in the relationship between the two people who are gossiping. And occasionally we'll find that what's happening is sometimes there's energy and excitement and camaraderie-ness. In that kind of feeling of, I feel connected to someone and reinforced by someone and justified and, you know, feel kind of special and we're kind of in it together, you know, can you believe that person? A lovely expression, may the one who, what does it say? Let the one who hasn't sinned cast the first stone. So, can you believe that person? What that person did? So aside from the ethics of all that, it's interesting to look at what's happening in the relationship between the two people doing it. And sometimes I think the attraction to gossip and slander is the good feeling that can come from the energy and the camaraderie, kind of warm kind of feeling that comes from that. And if we identify the good feeling that might be there, or the excitement or something, or the sense of feeling a little bit pumped up by it or something, if we can see that that's what's really we're tuning into, then perhaps we can reflect, is there a more healthy way to do that? It's a healthy way to create that kind of, that thing. But if we're unconscious of that part, that part of it, then we might kind of continue going for that so-called benefit without noticing what the effect is. So when we, our relationship and the relationship that gets formed is also relates to something as simple as our breathing as we pay attention to it in mindfulness. There's the breathing, there's me paying attention to my breath, and then there's a relationship that exists between the breath and myself. And the breath is a wonderful place to see it because the breath is malleable and shake a little bit, goes back and forth. How we are shapes how we breathe and return affects us. And so what is it that's going on? I'm trying to follow my breath. I've been told to follow my breath. I'm going to do it. But then what about the relationship to that? What's the relationship that exists between myself and the breath? Is it harsh? Got to do it, Shape that mind, whip that mind into shape and just keep it right there in the breath, Or is it kind? Let's be committed here to the being attention for the attentive to breath. Let's do it in a kind, loving way. Is there a sense of judgmentalism to the breath? And that's the worst breath I've ever had. I better do better next time. The next breath come along, I'm going to watch it really carefully, and so we're judging, or we're comparing. The person next to me seems to have a really good breath. Wow, look at that. And in Vipassana, we keep our eyes closed, so we don't notice. But in Zen, I've sat next to, just keep your eyes open, and sat next to people and been very aware of the breathing while I'm sitting there, because somehow it just so close. And wow, look at that. I hope they didn't notice my breath. And then, or there can be hesitation or resistance. I know it's supposed to be good for me to stay with the breath, but, I'm just rebellious. Whenever I'm told to do something, it's the last thing I'm going to do, but I'm supposed to do it. And so there's all this other stuff that goes on that exists there in the relationship, and how we relate to it. And so it's very important to look at that and notice that. So when we practice, it's not a matter of just focusing on the breath. It's also taking in how we are in relationship to the breathing. And in fact, how we are is more important than being able to successfully stay one breath at a time. So how we are. So it might also be that way when we talk in conversation with other people, that how we are might be more important than the object or the subject of the conversation. How are we in the situation? What do we bring to it? In order to become aware of ourselves more, and kind of begin understanding more what goes on in speech, I think it can be very helpful to notice the self-talk that goes on inside of our own mind. And so part of mindfulness practice is to notice what goes on in your own thinking. What are you thinking regularly? What's the flavor and the quality and the mood and the emotion that comes with how you're thinking? I know there's some people, and I think probably everyone at some points, can think without any reflection or mindfulness of what the act of thinking is like. If what we're thinking about is so important that somehow we just think away, and thinking is such a, for some people, it's such a common, integral part of who they are and what their life is about, that thinking is like It's supposed to be the fish doesn't see the water it swims in. I don't know if that's true, but you know we don't see the, you know, we don't see the air we walk through, so we don't see the thinking because it's kind of invisible and we're just so involved, so engaged in it, so caught up in it. But when people sit and meditate for a long time, day after day, there's much more than becoming calm that's important. And the long, patient, kind of ongoing work of meditating, slowly we begin noticing patterns in our thinking. We start becoming familiar with what goes on in a way that we can't if we just kind of barrel ahead with our life and think away freely, the way we can often do. And it's a very, you know, and especially in the silence of meditation, there's a way of kind of seeing it, our thinking, in a very different way, because we're not actively engaging in our thinking. We're not, you know, thinking about thinking or thinking about what we're thinking about. We're kind of stepping back and holding our thinking in a kind of more broader, expansive awareness. So then there's a lot of things to notice in the self-talk, the inner self-talk. It might be possible to notice how energetic is it? Is there a lot of energy in that self-talk? Is it really charged up and loud, screaming? Or is it very, very calm? Quiet, soft, or where is it in that range from being quiet and soft to being, you know, hyped up and loud and aggressive? And probably in the course of a day, your thinking might change its energy level. Certainly, I can watch mine change. And the other day, I was driving, and here in Redwood City, and this police car pulled up behind me as I was driving, followed me. Well, you know, I didn't think about it much. You know, I was driving exactly the speed limit, 25 miles an hour, no problem. Even if it went 27, I'm sure the police officer wouldn't have cared. But I was doing 20. I knew I was doing 25, and everything was fine. And I made an unusual turn down the unusual street. The officer followed me. Oh, just a coincidence. I made another unusual turn down another street, right in my tail. Well, there's no sirens on, but what's going on here? Well, my self-talk revved up. And you know, and other times it gets really quiet. So the energy, and so what do we learn from the energy level of the self-talk? You know, what can we learn from that? Probably the police officer, I think there was some kind of anxiety that started to surface that was kind of, you know, oh, look at that, I'm getting a little anxious. What have I done wrong? What in the world have I done wrong? And so that's the energy level. What's the energy level in there? The other interesting thing to do with self-talk is to listen to the emotional tone of the self-talk. And it's kind of like if you listen to someone who speaks a foreign language that you don't understand, sometimes, not always accurately, but sometimes you can kind of tell what emotions they are, you know, even if you don't understand the words. And so, oh, that person's angry, or that person is, you know, gentle, or that person is scared or something. Something in the tone, you can hear it. And so the same thing when we talk to ourselves, sometimes it's possible to be aware of the inner kind of mental attitude or tone or mood that's there. And some people find when they pay attention that it's always harsh in there. It's always critical. They might be kind, their speech externally, because we're so socialized, perhaps. But internally, it's really mean. There's a lot of meanness there, a lot of criticalness. And until they stop and pay attention, they realize, wow, I had no idea it was so much of it. Or there might be everything we think about is somehow couched or held in a flavor of anxiety, of worry. Everything's seen as being, you know, you worry about it. Or it might be that there's a flavor or mood of kindness that's there, or compassion. And so there's a kind of a wonderful feeling of caring and thoughts of caring that are there. So what's the mood or the emotional kind of tone or voice that inner voice is speaking from? The reason why all this stuff is important is that the flavor, the texture, the mood of the inner voice and how we talk will have a direct impact on how we speak out loud, one way or the other. And as we begin tracking what goes on inside with ourselves, it's a lot easier to track and be responsible for, be careful for what we say out loud. So if we don't know what we're thinking, and we don't know how our thinking is being influenced by our mood, by our emotional state, then we're not going to be so conscious of what we say out loud. And people often make mistakes. I wish they didn't say that. So one of the great skills, or one of the great skills and consequences of mindfulness practice and meditation is developing this familiarity with our inner life. So we can kind of track all these things and then learn also how to negotiate that inner landscape so that when we're really angry, we notice, oh, there's a lot of fury and heat in there. I think that this is not a good time to make decisions. Maybe that's not a good time to talk to, you know, that person. Let's wait. Let's have that conversation later. Or if there's a lot of anxiety in there, then it might be useful to go and look at that anxiety and settle it and work with it rather than letting it keep festering and kind of limit your life. So another whole area to look at around this inner talk, and then it translates very directly to the outer talk, is the intention that's connected to the talking, to the conversation. What is it we want? What are we trying to accomplish in the speech act, whether it's in our talking to ourselves or externally? And I'm not an expert in what I'm about to say, so maybe I shouldn't say it with a lot of too much enthusiasm or confidence. But it's my strong sense that if you want to jumpstart your mindfulness practice, if you want to really go deep quickly in Buddhist practice, here's the direct path. There's a very direct way. And that is, be aware of why you're saying what you're saying. Why are you saying what you're saying? Why are you saying what you're about to say? So say you go out to a restaurant for dinner, and the next day at work, you know, you go and you say, I just ate at the very best restaurant. Why are we saying that? Is it in fact the best restaurant? And how would you know? Have you been to all of them? And why are we saying that? And it might be that it's sharing our enthusiasm, our delight, in which case we just share the delight of the person. Or it might be a subtle way of saying, I'm a really good restaurant chooser. And the one that I went to was really good. It reflects on who I am. What is it, when we speak, what are we trying to do? The story I like to tell, I apologize those of you who heard it before, of coming to teach one Monday night back in Palo Alto days, and an old friend I hadn't seen for a long time happened to be there just as I walked in through the door. And there wasn't really time to talk very much, just a couple of words back and forth. And the last thing I said to the person and to anyone before I went and meditated was I said to this old friend of mine, I didn't prepare my talk today. So because that was the last thing I said when I sat down to meditate, it kind of echoed in my mind. And I said, why did I say that? And I realized the reason I said it was true. I wasn't particularly prepared. It was a true statement. But was this important news to broadcast to the world? Why did I feel like this was necessary to tell the friend? That, you know, was it useful for my friend to know it? It wasn't for my friend's sake that I said it. It was for my sake. And I was protecting myself. So that if I gave a lousy talk, I was covered. I wasn't prepared, so, you know, what can you expect? So what are we trying to do? Why are we saying what we're saying? How many times is what we're saying, we're saying it because this is useful information that the person needs to know? Like if someone asks you, you know, where's the closest drugstore, pharmacy? You might say, oh, just go down El Camino, 4 blocks, take a left. That's useful information. But how much of what passes back and forth in conversation is just useful information that needs to be exchanged? I suspect it's very little. There's a lot more going on in conversation just exchanging information, even when we seem to be the case. What are we trying to accomplish when we speak? Some of it is we're trying to create a relationship. We're trying to be in relationship to someone. And what's the nature of that relationship that we're interested in having or that we're creating in that act of speaking? It's really easy to be unconscious or not conscious about this, not aware of it. And sometimes we create very kind of even ugly kind of relationships by how we speak, what goes on. Sometimes we can get beautiful things. But to ask yourself the question, why am I saying what I'm going to say right now? And not to settle for one answer. Because there's often multiple agendas, multiple purposes behind saying something. Some of it might be to have the other person have a favorable impression of us. Look how smart I am, look how clever I am, look how whatever. It might be because we want to share in some wonderful camaraderie free feeling. It's a good feeling together. It's nice and warm. Share our friendship and our warmth together. Might be part of it. It might be that we're subtly trying to make sure that we get what we want out of the situation. That we're leading up to, you know, maybe you'll invite me to that restaurant. But you can't ask directly. So you ask, you know, tell me more about that restaurant. So there's all these different things. So what is it, why is it that we're saying what we're about to say? In order to be able to study that well, I think, the very important part of mindfulness practice is to be able to look back at ourselves and to look at the intentions by which we live. What is the intentions that we live our life by? And those are the intentions that exist on the broad scale. They're kind of global intentions. Maybe you need to kind of spend some time reflecting and thinking about in some big way. But also there's the small intentions that occur moment by moment. What is I'm wanting here? What am I trying to do here? What's the motivation in this situation? And before speaking, the impulse to speak, what's the flavor of it? Is it kind, caring, friendly, relaxed? Is that impulse insistent, impatient? Is that impulse to speak frightened, self-protective? Is the impulse to speak held back, checked, kept in check? Oh, I can't say that, no. What's that impulse like? And then behind that impulse to speak, is there an intention? Is there a wish? Is there a hope? Is there an attempt to try to accomplish something in that? Even saying hello to someone seems like a normal ritual thing to do, hello. But there's so much that can go into the hello. Someone yesterday told a story, the other day told a story of doing an exercise where two people had to be, I don't know, 50 feet away from each other. And then they had to walk towards each other. One of them stood still and the other one walked towards the one standing still. And the one standing still at some point would say, that's close enough. So, you know, when is close enough? And what this person said was, when the person got about 10 feet from me, that was close enough. And someone else in the group said, oh, you know, you know, I want contact. I'm, you know, it's two very different approaches. One person wants contact, and so just in coming together to say hello, there might be, and I noticed the person who wanted contact, I saw, you know, when she came over and said hello to me, she put her hand on my elbow. The other person, I can't remember ever being touched by that person. So even something saying hello, what are we accomplishing? What are we trying to do there? Are we trying to establish some close contact? Are we trying to establish distance? I see you, but don't get too close. There can be a lot in that very simple communication. So why are we about to say what we're going to say? Is a very, very insightful practice. That it'll take a while to get the hang of it. But one of the ways to get a hang of it is to develop a practice of looking what is at your own intentions inside. So the inner voice, you should pay attention to that. What's the intention behind your inner voice? What's your inner voice trying to accomplish when it tells you what it tells you? And there's layers and layers of this. Well, my inner voice is trying to judge me. Tell me how rotten I am. But why is that? What's behind that? And that not a few people I know have found when they kind of scratched below the surface of their judgmental, critical kind of mind and thinking and even talking, that behind that was an attempt to try to protect themselves. Protect themselves from being harmed, protect themselves from being criticized. And if I criticize other people so well, then I can be safe somehow. There's a variety of things. So to look at this. So I hope in saying this today, I haven't made too much, stayed away from the ethical side as much as I could of speech, just kind of the importance of looking and how much there is to look and notice in the act of speaking. And so that's why, one of the reasons why it's often encouraged that you should, useful to pause before you speak. Because in the pause, there's a chance to take all this in, some of this in, and what goes on. And then we might be able to handle the ethical stuff more carefully. So, is that enough? I hope that during the week, if you do it, take this up as a practice and exploration, looking at your self-talk, looking at why you say what you say, that you do it with a lot of kindness and friendliness to yourself. And it's also really good to do it with a sense of humor. It helps. Hold it lightly and enjoy it. And it's easier to enjoy it if you see that it's in the long term, it really benefits you and others to do this exploration. And as you explore it over the week, I would also strongly encourage you, go find someone you can talk to about what you're discovering. Have some conversations about this whole area so that you're sharing with someone else. And thank you so much.